This is Audible.
Simon & Schuster Audio presents The Corrections by Jonathan Franzen. Read by George Guidel.
St. Jude. The madness of an autumn prairie cold front coming through. You could feel it. Something terrible was going to happen. The sun low in the sky, a minor light, a cooling star. Gust after gust of disorder. Trees restless, temperatures falling, the whole northern religion of things coming to an end. No children in the yards here, shadows lengthened on yellowing zoysia. Red oaks and pin oaks and swamp white oaks rained acorns on houses with no mortgage. Storm windows shuddered in the empty bedrooms, and the drone and hiccup of a clothes dryer, the nasal contention of a leaf blower, the ripening of local apples in a paper bag, the smell of the gasoline with which Alfred Lambert had cleaned the paintbrush from his morning painting of the wicker love seat. 3 in the afternoon was a time of danger in these gerontocratic suburbs of St. Jude. Alfred had awakened in the great blue chair in which he'd been sleeping since lunch. He'd had his nap, and there would be no local news until 5 o'clock. 2 empty hours were a sinus in which infections bred. He struggled to his feet and stood by the ping-pong table, listening in vain for Enid. Ringing throughout the house was an alarm bell that no one but Alfred and Enid could hear directly. It was the alarm bell of anxiety. It was like one of those big cast-iron dishes with an electric clapper that sends schoolchildren into the street in fire drills. By now it had been ringing for so many hours that the Lamberts no longer heard the message of bell ringing, but, as with any sound that continues for so long that you have the leisure to learn its component sounds, as with any word you stare at until it resolves itself into a string of dead letters, instead heard a clapper rapidly striking a metallic resonator. Not a pure tone, but a granular sequence of percussions with a keening overlay of overtones, ringing for so many days that it simply blended into the background, except at certain early morning hours, when one or the other of them awoke in a sweat and realized that a bell had been ringing in their heads for as long as they could remember. Ringing for so many months that the sound had given way to a kind of meta-sound, whose rise and fall was not the beating of compression waves, but the much, much slower waxing and waning of their consciousness of the sound, which consciousness was particularly acute when the weather itself was in an anxious mood. Then Enid and Alfred, she on her knees in the dining room opening drawers, he in the basement surveying the disastrous ping-pong table, each felt near to exploding with anxiety. The anxiety of coupons in a drawer containing candles and designer autumn colors. The coupons were bundled in a rubber band, and Enid was realizing that their expiration dates, often jauntily circled in red by the manufacturer, lay months and even years in the past. That these 100-odd coupons, whose total face value exceeded $60, potentially $120 at the Chiltsville supermarket that doubled coupons, had all gone bad. Tilex, 60 cents off. Excedrin PM, $1 off. The dates were not even close. The dates were historical. The alarm bell had been ringing for years. She pushed the coupons back in among the candles and shut the drawer. She was looking for a letter that had come by registered mail some days ago. Alfred had heard the mailman knock on the door and had shouted, "Enid! Enid!" so loudly that he couldn't hear her shouting back, "Al, I'm getting it!" He'd continue to shout her name, coming closer and closer, and because the sender of the letter was the Axon Corporation, 24 East Industrial Serpentine, Schwenksville, Pennsylvania, and because there were aspects of the Axon situation that Enid knew about and hoped that Alfred didn't, she'd quickly stashed the letter somewhere within 15 feet of the front door. Alfred had emerged from the basement, bellowing like a piece of earth-moving equipment, "There's somebody at the door!" And she'd fairly screamed, "The mailman! The mailman!" And he'd shaken his head at the complexity of it all. Enid felt sure that her own head would clear, if only she didn't have to wonder every 5 minutes what Alfred was up to. But try as she might, she couldn't get him interested in life. When she encouraged him to take up his metallurgy again, he looked at her as if she'd lost her mind. When she asked whether there wasn't some yard work he could do, he said his legs hurt. When she reminded him that the husbands of her friends all had hobbies, Dave Schumpert, his stained glass, Kirby Root, his intricate chalets for nesting purple finches, Chuck Meisner, his hourly monitoring of his investment portfolio, Alfred acted as if she were trying to distract him from some great labor of his. And what was that labor? Repainting the porch furniture? He'd been repainting the loveseat since Labor Day. She seemed to recall that the last time he'd painted the furniture, he'd done the loveseat in 2 hours. Now he went to his workshop morning after morning, and after a month she ventured in to see how he was doing, and found that all he'd painted of the loveseat was the legs. He seemed to wish that she would go away. He said that the brush had got dried out, that was what was taking so long. He said that scraping wicker was like trying to peel a blueberry. He said that there were crickets. She felt a shortness of breath then, but perhaps it was only the smell of gasoline and of the dampness of the workshop that smelled like urine, but could not possibly be urine. She fled upstairs to look for the letter from Axon. 6 days a week, several pounds of mail came through the slot in the front door. And since nothing incidental was allowed to pile up downstairs, since the fiction of living in this house was that no one lived here, Enid faced a substantial tactical challenge. She didn't think of herself as a gorilla, but a gorilla was what she was. By day, she ferried materiel from depot to depot, often just a step ahead of the governing force. By night, beneath a charming but too dim sconce at a too small table in the breakfast nook, she staged various actions, paid bills, balanced checkbooks, attempted to decipher Medicare co-payment records and make sense of a threatening third notice from a medical lab that demanded immediate payment of 22 cents, while simultaneously showing an account balance of $0 carried forward and thus indicating that she owed nothing and, in any case, offering no address to which remittance might be made. It would happen that the first and second notices were underground somewhere, and because of the constraints under which Enid waged her campaign, she had only the dimmest sense of where those other notices might be on any given evening. She might suspect, perhaps, the family room closet, but the governing force, in the person of Alfred, would be watching a network news magazine at a volume thunderous enough to keep him awake, and he had every light in the family room burning, and there was a non-negligible possibility that if she opened the closet door, a cascade of catalogs and House Beautifuls and miscellaneous Merrill Lynch statements would come toppling and sliding out, incurring Alfred's wrath. There was also the possibility that the notices would not be there, since the governing force staged random raids on her depots, threatening to pitch the whole lot of it if she didn't take care of it. But she was too busy dodging these raids to ever quite take care of it, and in the succession of forced migrations and deportations, any lingering semblance of order was lost. And so the random Nordstrom shopping bag that was camped behind a dust ruffle with one of its plastic handles semi-detached would contain the whole shuffled pathos of a refugee existence. Non-consecutive issues of good housekeeping. black-and-white snapshots of Enid in the 1940s. Brown recipes on high-acid paper that called for wilted lettuce, the current month's telephone and gas bills, the detailed first notice from the medical lab instructing co-payers to ignore subsequent billings for less than 50 cents, a complimentary cruise ship photo of Enid and Alfred wearing Lay's and sipping beverages from hollow coconuts, and the only extant copies of two of their children's birth certificates. For example, although Enid's ostensible foe was Alfred, what made her a gorilla was the house that occupied them both. Its furnishings were of the kind that brooked no clutter. There were chairs and tables by Ethan Allen, Spode and Waterford in the breakfront, obligatory ficuses, obligatory Norfolk pines, fanned copies of Architectural Digest on a glass-topped coffee table, touristic plunder, enamelware from China, a Viennese music box that Enid, out of a sense of duty and mercy, every so often wound up and raised the lid of. The tune was Strangers in the Night. Unfortunately, Enid lacked the temperament to manage such a house, and Alfred lacked the neurological wherewithal. Alfred's cries of rage on discovering evidence of guerrilla actions, a Nordstrom bag surprised in broad daylight on the basement stairs, nearly precipitating a tumble, were the cries of a government that could no longer govern. He'd lately developed a knack for making his printing calculator spit columns of meaningless 8-digit figures. After he devoted the better part of an afternoon to figuring the cleaning woman's social security payments 5 different times and came up with 4 different numbers and finally just accepted the one number, $635.78, that he'd managed to come up with twice, the correct figure was $70, Enid staged a nighttime raid on his filing cabinet and relieved it of all tax files, which might have improved household efficiency had the files not found their way into a Nordstrom bag with some misleadingly ancient Good Housekeepings concealing the more germane documents underneath. Which casualty of war led to the cleaning woman's filling out the forms herself, with Enid merely writing the checks, and Alfred shaking his head at the complexity of it all. It's the fate of most ping-pong tables in home basements eventually to serve the ends of other, more desperate games. After Alfred retired, he appropriated the eastern end of the table for his banking and correspondence. At the western end was the portable color TV on which he'd intended to watch the local news while sitting in his great blue chair, but which was now fully engulfed by Good Housekeepings and the seasonal candy tins and baroque but cheaply made candle holders that Enid never quite found time to transport to the nearly new consignment shop. The ping-pong table was the one field on which the Civil War raged openly. At the eastern end, Alfred's calculator was ambushed by floral print potholders and souvenir coasters from the Epcot Center and a device for pitting cherries, which Enid had owned for 30 years and never used. While he, in turn, at the western end, for absolutely no reason that Enid could ever fathom, ripped to pieces a wreath made of pine cones and spray-painted filberts and Brazil nuts. To the east of the ping-pong table was the workshop that housed Alfred's metallurgical lab. The workshop was now home to a colony of mute, dust-colored crickets, which, when startled, would scatter across the room like a handful of dropped marbles, some of them misfiring at crazy angles, others toppling over with the weight of their own copious protoplasm. They popped all too easily, and cleanup took more than one Kleenex. Enid and Alfred had many afflictions which they believed to be extraordinary, outsized, shameful, and the crickets were one of them. The gray dust of evil spells and the cobwebs of enchantment thickly cloaked the old electric arc furnace, and the jars of exotic rhodium and sinister cadmium and stalwart bismuth and the hand-printed labels browned by the vapors from a glass-stoppered bottle of Aqua Regia, and the quad-ruled notebook in which the latest entry in Alfred's hand dated from a time 15 years ago, before the betrayals had begun. Something as daily and friendly as a pencil still occupied the random spot on the workbench where Alfred had laid it in a different decade. The passage of so many years imbued the pencil with a kind of enmity. Asbestos mitts hung from a nail beneath 2 certificates of U.S. patents, the frames warped and sprung by dampness. On the hood of a binocular microscope lay big chips of peeled paint from the ceiling. The only dust-free objects in the room were the wicker love seat, a can of Rust-Oleum, and some brushes, and a couple of Uban coffee cans, which, despite increasingly strong olfactory evidence, Enid chose not to believe were filling up with her husband's urine. Because what earthly reason could he have, with a nice little half-bathroom not 20 feet away, for peeing in a Uban can? To the west of the ping-pong table was Alfred's great blue chair. The chair was overstuffed, vaguely gubernatorial. It was made of leather, but it smelled like the inside of a Lexus. Like something modern and medical and impermeable, that you could wipe the smell of death off easily with a damp cloth before the next person sat down to die in it. The chair was the only major purchase Alfred had ever made without Enid's approval. When he'd traveled to China to confer with Chinese railroad engineers, Enid had gone along, and the two of them had visited a rug factory to buy a rug for their family room. They were unaccustomed to spending money on themselves, and so they chose one of the least expensive rugs with a simple blue design from the Book of Changes on a solid field of beige. A few years later, when Alfred retired from the Midland Pacific Railroad, he set about replacing the old cow-smelling black leather armchair in which he watched TV and took his naps. He wanted something really comfortable, of course, but after a lifetime of providing for others, he needed more than just comfort. He needed a monument to his need. So he went, alone, to a non-discount furniture store and picked out a chair of permanence. An engineer's chair, a chair so big that even a big man got lost in it. A chair designed to bear up under heavy stress. And because the blue of its leather vaguely matched the blue in the Chinese rug, Enid had no choice but to suffer its deployment in the family room. Soon, however, Alfred's hands were spilling decaffeinated coffee on the rug's beige expanses, and wild grandchildren were leaving berries and crayons underfoot, and Enid began to feel that the rug was a mistake. It seemed to her that in trying to save money in life, she had made many mistakes like this. She reached the point of thinking it would have been better to buy no rug than to buy this rug. Finally, as Alfred's naps deepened toward enchantment, she grew bolder. Her own mother had left her a tiny inheritance years ago. Interest had been added to principal, certain stocks had performed rather well, and now she had an income of her own. She reconceived the family room in greens and yellows. She ordered fabrics. A paper hanger came, and Alfred, who was napping temporarily in the dining room, leaped to his feet like a man with a bad dream. "You're redecorating again?" "It's my own money," Enid said. "This is how I'm spending it."
"And what about the money I made? What about the work I did?"
This argument had been effective in the past. It was, so to speak, the constitutional basis of the tyranny's legitimacy. But it didn't work now.
"That rug is nearly 10 years old, and we'll never get the coffee stains out," Enid answered.
Alfred gestured at his blue chair, which under the paper hanger's plastic drop cloths looked like something you might deliver to a power station on a flatbed truck. He was trembling with incredulity, unable to believe that Enid could have forgotten this crushing refutation of her arguments, this overwhelming impediment to her plans. It was as if all the unfreedom in which he'd spent his 7 decades of life were embodied in this six-year-old but essentially brand-new chair. He was grinning, his face aglow with the awful perfection of his logic.
"And what about the chair, then?" he said. "What about the chair?"
Enid looked at the chair. Her expression was merely pained, no more.
"I never liked that chair."
This was probably the most terrible thing she could have said to Alfred. The chair was the only sign he'd ever given of having a personal vision of the future. Enid's words filled him with such sorrow. He felt such pity for the chair, such solidarity with it, such astonished grief at its betrayal, that he pulled off the dropcloth and sank into its arms and fell asleep. It was a way of recognizing places of enchantment, people falling asleep like this. When it became clear that both the rug and Alfred's chair had to go, the rug was easily shed. Enid advertised in the free local paper and netted a nervous bird of a woman who was still making mistakes and whose 50s came out of her purse in a disorderly roll that she unpeeled and flattened with shaking fingers. But the chair? The chair was a monument and a symbol and could not be parted from Alfred. It could only be relocated. And so it went into the basement. And Alfred followed. And so, in the house of the Lamberts, as in St. Jude, as in the country as a whole, life came to be lived underground. Enid could hear Alfred upstairs now, opening and closing drawers. He became agitated whenever they were going to see their children. Seeing their children was the only thing he seemed to care about anymore. In the streaklessly clean windows of the dining room there was chaos. The berserk wind, the negating shadows. Enid had looked everywhere for the letter from the Axon Corporation, and she couldn't find it. Alfred was standing in the master bedroom, wondering why the drawers of his dresser were open, who had opened them, whether he had opened them himself. He couldn't help blaming Enid for his confusion, for witnessing it into existence, for existing herself as a person who could have opened these drawers.
"Al, what are you doing?"
He turned to the doorway where she'd appeared. He began a sentence, "I am..." But when he was taken by surprise, every sentence became an adventure in the woods. As soon as he could no longer see the light of the clearing from which he'd entered, he would realize that the crumbs he'd dropped for bearings had been eaten by birds. Silent, deft, darting things which he couldn't quite see in the darkness, but which were so numerous and swarming in their hunger that it seemed as if they were the darkness, as if the darkness weren't uniform, weren't an absence of light, but a teeming and corpuscular thing.
And indeed, when, as a studious teenager, he'd encountered the word crepuscular in Mackay's Treasury of English Verse, the corpuscles of biology had bled into his understanding of the word,
so that for his entire adult life he'd seen in twilight a corpuscularity as of the graininess of the high-speed film necessary for photography under conditions of low ambient light, as of a kind of sinister decay, and hence the panic of a man betrayed deep in the woods, whose darkness was the darkness of starlings blotting out the sunset, or black ants storming a dead opossum, a darkness that didn't just exist, but actively consumed the bearings that he'd sensibly established for himself, lest he be lost. But in the instant of realizing he was lost, time became marvelously slow, and he discovered hitherto unguessed eternities in the space between one word and the next. Or rather, he became trapped in that space between words and could only stand and watch as time sped on without him, the thoughtless, boyish part of him crashing on out of sight blindly through the woods, while he, trapped, the grown-up Al, watched in oddly impersonal suspense, to see if the panic-stricken little boy might, despite no longer knowing where he was or at what point he'd entered the woods of this sentence, still manage to blunder into the clearing, where Enid was waiting for him, unaware of any woods. "Packing my suitcase," he heard himself say. This sounded right. Verb, possessive noun. Here was a suitcase in front of him. An important confirmation. He'd betrayed nothing. But Enid had spoken again. The audiologist had said that he was mildly impaired. He frowned at her, not following.
"It's Thursday," she said louder. "We're not leaving until Saturday."
"Saturday," he echoed.
She berated him then, and for a while the crepuscular birds retreated. But outside, the wind had blown the sun out, and it was getting very cold. The failure. Down the long concourse they came unsteadily, Enid favoring her damaged hip, Alfred paddling at the air with loose-hinged hands and slapping the airport carpeting with poorly controlled feet, both of them carrying Nordic Pleasure Line's shoulder bags and concentrating on the floor in front of them, measuring out the hazardous distance 3 paces at a time. To anyone who saw them averting their eyes from the dark-haired New Yorkers careering past them, to anyone who caught a glimpse of Alfred's straw fedora looming at the height of Iowa corn on Labor Day, or the yellow wool of the slacks stretching over Enid's outslung hip, it was obvious that they were Midwestern and intimidated. But to Chip Lambert, who was waiting for them just beyond the security checkpoint, they were killers. Chip had crossed his arms defensively and raised one hand to pull on the wrought-iron rivet in his ear. He worried that he might tear the rivet right out of his earlobe, that the maximum pain his ear's nerves could generate was less pain than he needed now to steady himself. From his station by the metal detectors, he watched an azure-haired girl overtake his parents, an azure-haired girl of college age, a very wantable stranger with pierced lips and eyebrows. It struck him that if he could have sex with this girl for 1 second, he could face his parents confidently. And that if he could keep on having sex with this girl once every minute for as long as his parents were in town, he could survive their entire visit. Chip was a tall, gym-built man with crow's feet and sparse, butter-yellow hair. If the girl had noticed him, she might have thought he was a little too old for the leather he was wearing. As she hurried past him, he pulled harder on his rivet to offset the pain of her departure from his life forever, and to focus his attention on his father, whose face was brightening at the discovery of a son among so many strangers. In the lunging manner of a man floundering in water, Alfred fell upon Chip and grabbed Chip's hand and wrist as if they were a rope he'd been thrown. "Well," he said, "well." Enid came limping up behind him. "Chip," she cried, "what have you done to your ears?" "Dad?" "Mom?" Chip murmured through his teeth, hoping the azure-haired girl was out of earshot. "Good to see you." He had time for one subversive thought about his parents' Nordic Pleasure Lines shoulder bags. Either Nordic Pleasure Lines sent bags like these to every booker of its cruises as a cynical means of getting inexpensive walkabout publicity, or as a practical means of tagging the cruise participants for greater ease of handling at embarkation points, or as a benign means of building esprit de corps. Or else Enid and Alfred had deliberately saved the bags from some previous Nordic Pleasure Lines cruise and, out of a misguided sense of loyalty, had chosen to carry them on their upcoming cruise as well. And in either case, Chip was appalled by his parents' willingness to make themselves vectors of corporate advertising, before he shouldered the bags himself and assumed the burden of seeing LaGuardia Airport and New York City and his life and clothes and body through the disappointed eyes of his parents.
He noticed, as if for the first time, the dirty linoleum. The assassin-like chauffeurs holding up signs with other people's names on them. The snarl of wires dangling from a hole in the ceiling. He distinctly heard the word motherfucker. Outside the big windows on the baggage level, two Bangladeshi men were pushing a disabled cab through rain and angry honking.
"We have to be at the pier by 4, Enid said to Chip. "And I think Dad was hoping to see your desk at the Wall Street Journal." She raised her voice. "Al? Al?"
Though stooped in the neck now, Alfred was still an imposing figure. His hair was white and thick and sleek, like a polar bear's, and the powerful long muscles of his shoulders, which Chip remembered laboring in the spanking of a child, usually Chip himself, still filled the gray tweed shoulders of his sport coat.
"Al, didn't you say you wanted to see where Chip worked?" Enid shouted.
Alfred shook his head.
"There's no time."
The baggage carousel circulated nothing.
"Did you take your pill?" Enid said.
"Yes,"
Alfred said. He closed his eyes and repeated slowly, "I took my pill, I took my pill, I took my pill."
"Dr. Hedgepeth has him on a new medication," Enid explained to Chip, who was quite certain that his father had not, in fact, expressed interest in seeing his office.
And since Chip had no association with the Wall Street Journal, the publication to which he made unpaid contributions was the Warren Street Journal, a monthly of the transgressive arts. He had also, very recently, completed a screenplay, and he'd been working part-time as a legal proofreader at Bragg, Neuter, and Spey for the nearly 2 years since he'd lost his assistant professorship in textual artifacts at D. College in Connecticut as a result of an offense involving a female undergraduate which had fallen just short of the legally actionable and which, though his parents never learned of it, had interrupted the parade of accomplishments that his mother could brag about back home in St. Jude. He'd told his parents that he'd quit teaching in order to pursue a career in writing, and when, more recently, his mother had pressed him for details, he'd mentioned the Warren Street Journal, the name of which his mother had misheard, and instantly begun to trumpet to her friends Esther Root and B. Meisner and Mary Beth Schumpert, and though Chip in his monthly phone calls home had had many opportunities to disabuse her, he'd instead actively fostered the misunderstanding. And here, things became rather complex, not only because the Wall Street Journal was available in St. Jude, and his mother had never mentioned looking for his work and failing to find it, meaning that some part of her knew perfectly well that he didn't write for the paper, but also because the author of articles like Creative Adultery and Let Us Now Praise Scuzzy Motels was conspiring to preserve in his mother precisely the kind of illusion that the Warren Street Journal was dedicated to exploding. And he was 39 years old, and he blamed his parents for the person he had become. He was happy when his mother let the subject drop.
"His tremor's much better," Enid added in a voice inaudible to Alfred. "The only side effect is that he may hallucinate."
"That's quite a side effect," Chip said.
"Dr. Hedgepeth says that what he has is very mild and almost completely controllable with medication."
Alfred was surveying the baggage claim cavern while pale travelers angled for position at the carousel. There was a confusion of tread patterns on the linoleum, gray with the pollutants that the rain had brought down. The light was the color of car sickness.
"New York City," Alfred said.
Enid frowned at Chip's pants.
"Those aren't leather, are they?"
"Yes."
"How do you wash them?"
"They're leather. They're like a second skin."
"We have to be at the pier no later than 4 o'clock, Enid said.
The carousel coughed up some suitcases.
"Chip, help me,"
his father said. Soon Chip was staggering out into the wind-blown rain with all 4 of his parents' bags. Alfred shuffled forward with the jerking momentum of a man who knew there would be trouble if he had to stop and start again. Enid lagged behind, intent on the pain in her hip. She'd put on weight, and maybe lost a little height since Chip had last seen her. She'd always been a pretty woman, but to Chip she was so much a personality and so little anything else that even staring straight at her he had no idea what she really looked like.
"What's that? Wrought iron?"
Alfred asked him as the taxi line crept forward. "Yes," Chip said, touching his ear.
"Looks like an old quarter-inch rivet."
"Yes."
"What do you do, crimp that? Hammer it?"
"It's hammered," Chip said. Alfred winced and gave a low, inhaling whistle.
"We're doing a luxury fall color cruise," Enid said when the three of them were in a yellow cab speeding through Queens. "We sail up to Quebec, and then we enjoy the changing leaves all the way back down. Dad so enjoyed the last cruise we were on. Didn't you, Al? Didn't you have a good time on that cruise?"
The brick palisades of the East River waterfront were taking an angry beating from the rain. Chip could have wished for a sunny day, a clear view of landmarks and blue water with nothing to hide. The only colors on the road this morning were the smeared reds of brake lights.
"This is one of the great cities of the world," Alfred said with emotion.
"How are you feeling these days, Dad?" Chip managed to ask.
"Any better, I'd be in heaven. Any worse, I'd be in hell."
"We're excited about your new job," Enid said.
"One of the great papers in the country," Alfred said. "The Wall Street Journal."
"Does anybody smell fish, though?"
"We're near the ocean," Chip said.
"No, it's you."
Enid leaned and buried her face in Chip's leather sleeve.
"Your jacket smells strongly of fish."
He wrenched free of her. "Mother, please." Chip's problem was a loss of confidence. Gone were the days when he could afford to épater les bourgeois. Except for his Manhattan apartment and his handsome girlfriend, Julia Vrace, he now had almost nothing to persuade himself that he was a functioning male adult. No accomplishments to compare with those of his brother, Gary, who was a banker and a father of three, or of his sister, Denise, who at the age of 32 was the executive chef at a successful new high-end restaurant in Philadelphia. Chip had hoped he might have sold his screenplay by now, but he hadn't finished a draft until after midnight on Tuesday, and then he'd had to work 3 14-hour shifts at Bragg, Neuter & Spey to raise cash to pay his August rent and reassure the owner of his apartment, Chip had a sublease, about his September and October rent, and then there was a lunch to be shopped for and an apartment to be cleaned and, finally, sometime before dawn this morning, a long-hoarded Xanax to be swallowed. Meanwhile, nearly a week had gone by without his seeing Julia or speaking to her directly. In response to the many nervous messages he'd left on her voicemail in the last 48 hours, asking her to meet him and his parents and Denise at his apartment at noon on Saturday, and also, please, if possible, not to mention to his parents that she was married to someone else, Julia had maintained a total phone and email silence from which even a more stable man than Chip might have drawn disturbing conclusions. It was raining so hard in Manhattan that water was streaming down facades and frothing at the mouths of sewers. Outside his building on East 9th Street, Chip took money from Enid and handed it through the cab's partition, and even as the turbaned driver thanked him, he realized the tip was too small. From his own wallet he took 2 singles and dangled them near the driver's shoulder.
"That's enough, that's enough," Enid squeaked, reaching for Chip's wrist. "He already said thank you."
But the money was gone. Alfred was trying to open the door by pulling on the window crank. "Here, Dad, it's this one," Chip said, and leaned across him to pop the door.
"How big a tip was that?"
Enid asked Chip on the sidewalk under his building's marquee as the driver heaved luggage from the trunk. "About 15%. Chip said.
"More like 20, I'd say," Enid said.
"Let's have a fight about this, why don't we?"
20%'s too much, Chip," Alfred pronounced in a booming voice. "It's not reasonable." "You all have a good day now," the taxi driver said, with no apparent irony.
"The tip is for service and comportment," Enid said. If the service and comportment are especially good, I might give 15%, but if you automatically tip...
I've suffered from depression all my life, Alfred said, or seemed to say.
Excuse me? Chip said.
Depression years changed me. They changed the meaning of a dollar.
An economic depression we're talking about. Then when the service really is especially good or especially bad, Enid pursued, there's no way to express it monetarily.
A dollar is still a lot of money, Alfred said.
15% of the service is exceptional, really exceptional.
I'm wondering why we're having this particular conversation, Chip said to his mother. Why this conversation and not some other conversation?
We're both terribly anxious, Enid replied, to see where you work.
Chip's doorman, Zoroaster, hurried out to help with the luggage and installed the Lamberts in the building's bulky elevator. Enid said,
I ran into your old friend Dean Driblet at the bank the other day. I never run into Dean but where he doesn't ask about you. He was impressed with your new writing job.
Dean Driblet was a classmate, not a friend, Chip said.
He and his wife just had their fourth child. I told you, didn't I? They built that enormous house out in Paradise Valley. Al, didn't you count 8 bedrooms?
Alfred gave her a steady, unblinking look. Chip leaned on the door close button.
"Dad and I were at the housewarming in June," Enid said. "It was spectacular. They'd had it catered, and they had pyramids of shrimp. It was solid shrimp in pyramids. I've never seen anything like it."
"Pyramids of shrimp," Chip said. The elevator door had finally closed.
"Anyway, it's a beautiful house," Enid said. "There are at least 6 bedrooms, and, you know, it looks like they're going to fill them. Dean's tremendously successful." He started that lawn care business when he decided the mortuary business wasn't for him. Well, you know, Dale Driblet's his stepdad, you know, the Driblet Chapel, and now his billboards are everywhere, and he started an HMO. I saw in the paper where it's the fastest-growing HMO in St. Jude. It's called DD Care, same as the lawn care business. And there are billboards for the HMO now, too. He's quite the entrepreneur, I'd say.
Slow elevator, Alfred said.
This is a pre-war building, Chip explained in a tight voice, an extremely desirable building. But you know what he told me he's doing for his mother's birthday? It's still a surprise for her, but I can tell you, he's taking her to Paris for 8 days, 2 first-class tickets, 8 nights at the Ritz. That's the kind of person Dean is, very family-oriented. But can you believe that kind of birthday present? Al, didn't you say the house alone probably cost $1 million? Al?
It's a large house, but cheaply done,
Alfred said with sudden vigor. The walls are like paper.
All the new houses are like that, Enid said.
You asked me if I was impressed with the house. I thought it was ostentatious. I thought the shrimp was ostentatious. It was poor.
It may have been frozen, Enid said.
People are easily impressed with things like that, Alfred said. They'll talk for months about the pyramids of shrimp. Well, see for yourself, he said to Chip, as to a neutral bystander. Your mother's still talking about it.
For a moment it seemed to Chip that his father had become a likable old stranger. But he knew Alfred underneath to be a shouter and a punisher. The last time Chip had visited his parents in St. Jude, 4 years earlier, he'd taken along his then-girlfriend, Ruthie, a peroxided young Marxist from the north of England, who, after committing numberless offences against Enid's sensibilities, she lit a cigarette indoors, laughed out loud at Enid's favourite watercolours of Buckingham Palace, came to dinner without a bra, and failed to take even one bite of the salad of water chestnuts and green peas and cheddar cheese cubes in a thick mayonnaise sauce which Enid made for festive occasions, had needled and baited Alfred until he pronounced that the blacks would be the ruination of this country. The blacks were incapable of coexisting with whites. They expected the government to take care of them. They didn't know the meaning of hard work. What they lacked above all was discipline. It was going to end with slaughter in the streets. With slaughter in the streets. And he didn't give a damn what Ruthie thought of him. She was a visitor in his house and his country, and she had no right to criticize things she didn't understand. Whereupon Chip, who'd already warned Ruthie that his parents were the squarest people in America, had smiled at her as if to say, "You see, exactly as advertised." When Ruthie had dumped him, not 3 weeks later, she'd remarked that he was more like his father than he seemed to realize.
"Al," Enid said as the elevator lurched to a halt, "you have to admit that it was a very, very nice party, and that it was very nice of Dean to invite us."
Alfred seemed not to have heard her. Propped outside Chip's apartment was a clear plastic umbrella that Chip recognized with relief as Julia Vrace's. He was herding the parental luggage from the elevator when his apartment door swung open and Julia herself stepped out.
Oh,
she said, as though flustered, "you're early." By Chip's watch, it was 11:35. Julia was wearing a shapeless lavender raincoat and holding a DreamWorks tote bag. Her hair, which was long and the color of dark chocolate, was big with humidity and rain. In the tone of a person being friendly to large animals, she said, "Hi," to Alfred, and "Hi," separately to Enid. Alfred and Enid bayed their names at her and extended hands to shake, driving her back into the apartment, where Enid began to pepper her with questions in which Chip, as he followed with the luggage, could hear subtexts and agendas.
"Do you live in the city?" Enid said. "You're not cohabiting with our son, are you? And you work in the city, too? You are gainfully employed. You're not from an alien, snobbish, moneyed Eastern family. Did you grow up here? Or do you come from a trans-Appalachian state where people are warm-hearted and down-to-earth and unlikely to be Jewish? Oh, and do you still have family in Ohio? Have your parents perhaps taken the morally dubious modern step of getting divorced? Do you have brothers or sisters? Are you a spoiled only child? Or a Catholic with a zillion siblings?"
Julia having passed this initial examination, Enid turned her attention to the apartment. Chip, in a late crisis of confidence, had tried to make it presentable. He'd bought a stain removal kit and lifted the big semen stain off the red chaise longue, dismantled the wall of wine bottle corks with which he'd been bricking in the niche above his fireplace at a rate of half a dozen Merlots and Pinot Grigios a week, taken down from his bathroom wall the close-up photographs of male and female genitalia that were the flower of his art collection, and replaced them with the three diplomas that Enid had long ago insisted on having framed for him. This morning, feeling as if he'd surrendered too much of himself, he'd readjusted his presentation by wearing leather to the airport.
"This room is about the size of Dean Driblet's bathroom," Enid said. "Wouldn't you say, Al?"
Alfred rotated his bobbing hands and examined their dorsal sides.
"I'd never seen such an enormous bathroom."
"Enid, you have no tact," Alfred said.
It might have occurred to Chip that this, too, was a tactless remark, since it implied that his father concurred in his mother's criticism of the apartment and objected only to her airing of it. But Chip was unable to focus on anything but the hairdryer protruding from Julia's DreamWorks tote bag. It was the hairdryer that she kept in his bathroom. She seemed, actually, to be heading out the door.
"Dean and Trish have a whirlpool and a shower stall and a tub, all separate," Enid went on. "The sinks are his and hers."
"Chip, I'm sorry," Julia said. He raised a hand to put her on hold. "We're going to have lunch here as soon as Denise comes," he announced to his parents. "It's a very simple lunch. Just make yourselves at home."
"It was nice to meet you both," Julia called to Enid and Alfred.
To Chip, in a lower voice, she said, "Denise will be here. You'll be fine." She opened the door.
"Mom, Dad," Chip said, "just 1 second."
He followed Julia out of the apartment and let the door fall shut behind him. "This is really unfortunate timing," he said. "Just really, really unfortunate."
Julia shook her hair back off her temples.
"I'm feeling good about the fact that it's the first time in my life I've ever acted self-interestedly in a relationship." "That's nice. That's a big step." Chip made an effort to smile. "But what about the script? Is Eden reading it?"
"I think maybe this weekend sometime."
"What about you?"
"I read, Julia looked away, "most of it."
"My idea," Chip said, "was to have this hump that the moviegoer has to get over, putting something off-putting at the beginning. It's a classic modernist strategy. There's a lot of rich suspense toward the end."
Julia turned toward the elevator and didn't reply.
"Did you get to the end yet?" Chip asked.
"Oh, Chip," she burst out miserably.
"Your script starts off with a 6-page lecture about anxieties of the phallus in Tudor drama."
He was aware of this.
Indeed, for weeks now, he'd been awakening most nights before dawn, his stomach churning and his teeth clenched, and had wrestled with the nightmarish certainty that a long academic monologue on Tudor drama had no place in Act One of a commercial script. Often it took him hours, took getting out of bed, pacing around, drinking Merlot or Pinot Grigio, to regain his conviction that a theory-driven opening monologue was not only not a mistake, but the script's most powerful selling point. And now, with a single glance at Julia, he could see that he was wrong. Nodding in heartfelt agreement with her criticism, he opened the door of his apartment and called to his parents. "One second, Mom, Dad, just one second." As he shut the door again, however, the old arguments came back to him. "You see, though," he said, "the entire story is prefigured in that monologue. Every single theme is there in capsule form: gender, power, identity, authenticity. And the thing is, wait, Julia?" Bowing her head sheepishly, as though she'd somehow hoped he wouldn't notice she was leaving, Julia turned away from the elevator and back toward him. "The thing is," he said, "the girl is sitting in the front row of the classroom, listening to the lecture. It's a crucial image, the fact that he is controlling the discourse."
"And it's a little creepy, though," Julia said, "the way you keep talking about her breasts."
This, too, was true. That it was true, however, seemed unfair and cruel to Chip, who would never have had the heart to write the script at all without the lure of imagining the breasts of his young female lead. "You're probably right," he said, "although some of the physicality there is intentional, because that's the irony, see, that she's attracted to his mind while he's attracted to her." "But for a woman reading it," Julia said obstinately, "it's sort of like the poultry department: breast, 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 thigh, leg." "I can remove some of those references," Chip said in a low voice. "I can also shorten the opening lecture. The thing is, though, I want there to be a hump right for the moviegoer to get over. That's a neat idea. Please come and have lunch. Please, Julia." The elevator door had opened at her touch. "I'm saying it's a tiny bit insulting to a person somehow." "But that's not you. It's not even based on you." "Oh, great. It's somebody else's breasts." "Jesus, please, 1 second." Chip turned back to his apartment door and opened it, and this time he was startled to find himself face to face with his father. Alfred's big hands were shaking violently. "Dad, hi, just another minute here." "Chip," Alfred said, "ask her to stay. Tell her we want her to stay." Chip nodded and closed the door in the old man's face. But in the few seconds his back had been turned, the elevator had swallowed Julia. He punched the call button to no avail, and then opened the fire door and ran down the spiral of the service stairwell. After a series of effulgent lectures celebrating the unfettered pursuit of pleasure as a strategy of subverting the bureaucracy of rationalism, Bill Quaintance, an attractive young professor of textual artifacts, is seduced by his beautiful and adoring student, Mona. Their wildly erotic affair has hardly begun, however, when they are discovered by Bill's estranged wife, Hilaire. in a tense confrontation representing the clash of therapeutic and transgressive world views, Bill and Hilaire struggle for the soul of young Mona, who lies naked between them untangled sheets. Hilaire succeeds in seducing Mona with her crypto-repressive rhetoric, and Mona publicly denounces Bill. Bill loses his job, but soon discovers email records proving that Hilaire has given Mona money to ruin his career. As Bill is driving to see his lawyer with a diskette containing the incriminating evidence, his car is run off the road into the raging Dee River, and the diskette floats free of the sunken car and is borne by ceaseless, indomitable currents into the raging, erotic-slash-chaotic open sea, and the crash is ruled vehicular suicide. And in the film's final scenes, Hilaire is hired to replace Bill on the faculty and is seen lecturing on the evils of unfettered pleasure to a classroom in which is seated her diabolical lesbian lover, Mona. This was the one-page précis that Chip had assembled with the aid of store-bought screenwriting manuals and had faxed one winter morning to a Manhattan-based film producer named Eden Procuro. 5 minutes later, he'd answered his phone to the cool, blank voice of a young woman saying, "Please hold for Eden Procuro," followed by Eden Procuro herself, crying, "I love it, love it, love it, love it, love it." But now a year and a half had passed. Now the one-page précis had become a 124-page script called The Academy Purple. And now Julia Vrace, the chocolate-haired owner of that cool, blank personal assistant's voice, was running away from him, and as he raced downstairs to intercept her, planting his feet sideways to take the steps 3 and 4 at a time, grabbing the newel at each landing and reversing his trajectory with a jerk, all he could see or think of was a damning entry in his nearly photographic mental concordance of those 124 pages. 3. Bee-stung lips, high-round breasts, narrow hips, and 3. Over the cashmere sweater that snugly hugs her breasts. 4. Forward raptly, her perfect adolescent breasts eagerly. 8. Eyeing her breasts. 9. Eyeing her breasts. 9. His eyes drawn helplessly to her perfect breasts. 11. Eyeing her breasts. 12. Mentally fondling her perfect breasts. 13. Eyeing her breasts. 15. Eyeing and eyeing her perfect adolescent breasts. 23. Clinch, her perfect breasts surging against his. 24. The repressive bra to unfetter her subversive breasts. 28. To pinkly tongue one sweat-sheened breast. 29. Phallically jutting nipple of her sweat-drenched breast. 29. I like your breasts. 30. Absolutely adore your honeyed, heavy breasts. 33. Hilaire's breasts, like twin Gestapo bullets, can be. 36. Barbed glare, as if to puncture and deflate her breasts. 44. Arcadian breasts, with stern puritanical terry cloth and. 45. Cowering, ashamed, the towel clutched to her breasts. 76. Her guileless breasts, shrouded now in militaristic. 83. I miss your body. I miss your perfect breasts. I. 117. Drowned headlights, fading like two milk-white breasts. And there were probably even more. More than he could remember. And the only two readers who mattered now were women. It seemed to Chip that Julia was leaving him because the Academy Purple had too many breast references and a draggy opening, and that if he could correct these few obvious problems, both on Julia's copy of the script and, more important, on the copy he'd specially laser-printed on 24-pound ivory-bound paper for Eden Procuro, there might be hope not only for his finances, but also for his chances of ever again unfettering and fondling Julia's own guileless milk-white breasts.
which by this point in the day, as by late morning of almost every day in recent months, was one of the last activities on earth in which he could still reasonably expect to take solace for his failures.
Exiting the stairwell into the lobby, he found the elevator waiting to torment its next rider. Through the open street door, he saw a taxi extinguish its roof light and pull away. Zoroaster was mopping up inblown water from the lobby's checkerboard marble. "Goodbye, Mr. Chip," he quipped, by no means for the first time, as Chip ran outside. Big raindrops beating on the sidewalk raised a fresh, cold mist of pure humidity. Through the bead curtain of water coming off the marquee, Chip saw Julia's cab brake for a yellow light. Directly across the street, another cab had stopped to discharge a passenger, and it occurred to Chip that he could take this other cab and ask the driver to follow Julia. The idea was tempting, but there were difficulties. One difficulty was that by chasing Julia, he would arguably be committing the worst of the offenses for which the General Counsel of D College, in a shrill, moralistic lawyer's letter, had once upon a time threatened to countersue him or have him prosecuted. The alleged offenses had included fraud, breach of contract, kidnap, Title IX sexual harassment, serving liquor to a student under the legal drinking age, and possession and sale of a controlled substance. But it was the accusation of stalking, of making obscene and threatening and abusive telephone calls and trespassing with intent to violate a young woman's privacy that had really scared Chip, and scared him still. A more immediate difficulty was that he had $4 in his wallet, less than $10 in his checking account, no credit to speak of on any of his major credit cards, and no prospect of further proofreading work until Monday afternoon. Considering that the last time he'd seen Julia, 6 days ago, she'd specifically complained that he always wanted to stay home and eat pasta and always be kissing her and having sex, she'd said that sometimes she almost felt like he used sex as a kind of medication, and that maybe the reason he didn't just go ahead and self-medicate with crack or heroin instead was that sex was free, and he was turning into such a cheapskate. She'd said that now that she was taking an actual prescription medication herself, she sometimes felt like she was taking it for both of them, and that this seemed doubly unfair because she was the one who paid for the medication and because the medication made her slightly less interested in sex than she used to be. She'd said that if it were up to Chip, they probably wouldn't even go to movies anymore, but would spend the whole weekend wallowing in bed with the shades down and then reheating pasta. He suspected that the minimum price of further conversation with her would be an overpriced lunch of mesquite-grilled autumn vegetables and a bottle of Sancerre for which he had no conceivable way of paying. And so he stood and did nothing, as the corner traffic light turned green and Julia's cab drove out of sight. Rain was lashing the pavement in white, infected-looking